and okay. You're good to go.
Sure. Okay, can everybody hear me? My name is Andrew Fabiano. I'm one of the neurosurgeons here at Roswell Park. I specialize in surgical management of tumors of the brain and spine. I'm originally from Buffalo and did the majority of my training here. And I've been on staff at Roswell for about 8 years. So the topic today is brain tumors. And as we go through, I'll point out areas that specifically to know in terms of the test. And if I don't specifically tell you to be concerned about it, you don't have to really worry about learning it for test purposes. So in terms of brain tumors, some of the basics, it's a very broad category. There's, a tremendous amount of different types and subtypes of brain tumors. Each case is unique. But we'll talk about some of just the basics in terms of what you are considering when you're managing brain tumor and talk about some of the different tumor types and look at some cases. This is an MRI of the brain. MRI, the orientation is if the patient's laying flat and their feet are coming out at you. So this would be the patient's left side. This is the right side. This is the substance of the brain. The ventricles are fluid spaces within the brain. These are those ventricles. And this is a tumor growing in the front part of the brain. So one of the concepts, key concepts in consideration of brain tumor management is the fact that the skull is a fixed space. So the bone of the skull is fixed. The brain normally fills the skull. So if you have something growing inside the skull, in order for it to grow like that, it has to push away the normal brain. The brain can accommodate that growth to some extent, but once it's pushed and compressed it enough, the underlying normal brain stops functioning right, and that is when you start to develop symptoms. So the symptoms you develop from your brain tumor are based upon what area of the brain is being compressed. So the motor cortex is a very important area. It controls motor function on the other side of your body. If something compresses that even a little bit and affects motor function, you typically notice it right away. The temporal lobe, particularly the left temporal lobe, in most people houses speech function. And if you have a tumor there that affects your ability to speak or understand speech, on the temporal lobe would be more your ability to understand speech. Again, that's something you notice. Frontal lobe controls higher functions such as memory, concentration, motivation, emotions. And when those things are off, you don't necessarily think right away it's something with the brain. People might be diagnosed with depression or some other issue prior to having their brain evaluated. And so sometimes tumors there can grow real large before they're discovered. So inflammation, irritation of the surrounding brain occurs. And once that happens, patients start to develop symptoms. There's a breakdown of the normal blood-brain barrier around a brain or a tumor. There can be. Corticosteroids are a medication that's used to treat that vasogenic edema that occurs around a tumor, and anti-epileptics are often started to prevent seizures. So corticosteroids, dexamethasone is the one that's traditionally used. These are medications that, through a not completely understood mechanism, help to reduce the edema around a brain tumor. Once that edema goes down, patients often have an improvement in their symptoms. And these patients are at risk for stomach ulcers, so we always treat them with GI prophylactic medication as well. Steroids have a lot of side effects. You can see this patient's what we call cushionoid. He has features of iatrogenic steroid use. These can include diabetes, myopathy, increased risk of infection, emotional lability, weight gain, you get kind of chubby cheeks and a buffalo hump, and they can have wound issues as well. Anti-epileptic drugs, these are used for cortical lesions. The cerebellum, the back part of the brain, does not cause seizures, so tumors back there, they don't require anti-epileptics. Different medications are used. The key point is that, you know, anything that's irritating the cortex of the brain can lead to a seizure. So we'll talk about some different tumor types. Gliomas are tumors that arise from the substance of the brain. Meningiomas arise from the covering of the brain or the dura. Metastatic tumors are tumors that spread to the brain from a different area. And pituitary tumors arise in the region of the pituitary gland, which hangs down from the base of the brain. So this is a brain that's sectioned in half. This is the front part of the brain. A person's eyeball would be kind of right in here. The top of the head, the back of the head. This is that cerebellum I was talking about, the back part of the brain. Pituitary gland hangs down here from the base of the brain and controls hormone function in the body. And this is cerebral cortex. So gliomas are tumors that arise from native cells within the brain. The World Health Organization classifies gliomas. They actually just updated their classification system in 2016. So I've been giving this lecture for a few years, and what I said, you know, even a few years ago was already outdated. They're divided into category 1, 2, 3, 4. One is a benign tumor, basically, where if it's completely removed, it's cured. Two and three are often kind of mixed together as either intermediate or low-grade gliomas are called. The one that you need, really need to know is WHO grade 4, which is a glioblastoma. Okay, it's the most common primary tumor in the brain. So the way that the gliomas are classified is when you get a sample of it and the pathologist actually looks at it. So some of what the pathologist is looking at to determine what grade the glioma is are whether or not there's mitoses present, how many, if there's microvascular proliferation, if there's nuclear atypia, any necrosis, what the Ki-67 proliferation index is. That's basically a test that can be done to tell how fast the cells are dividing. As you can guess, the quicker they're dividing, the higher the potential grade. These are the more traditional methods, and now with improvements in genetic understanding and being able to genetically evaluate the tumors, we know there's a specific gene, IDH1, that when mutated actually gives patients a better overall prognosis compared to the wild type. And for the intermediate grade tumors, this 1P92 co-deletion helps to, one, make the diagnosis of a specific type of glioma, oligodendroglioma, and it also increases the patient's likelihood for chemosensitivity. So that would be a potential test question. You don't have to know all of these things. What you have to know is, the test question would be the characteristics that are used to determine the grade of a glioma are mitosis, nuclear atypia, Ki-67, IDH1, all the above, and it would be all the above. So this is a typical WHO1 glioma. They usually have an enhancing nodule and a cystic portion. And again, if you can completely resect these, it's curative. They're more common in children. You can get a sense now from these grade 2 and grade 3 lesions, rather than being something discrete in the brain, they're more of an infiltrative process. In some instances, depending on where they are in the brain, they can be resected. In others, they can't, and they're treated with biopsy and radiation. And here's your WHO grade 4 glioblastoma. I didn't update my slides. It used to be called glioblastoma multiforme, an abbreviated GBM, but they dropped the multiforme part in the updated WHO classification. But for glioblastoma, they're usually enhanced with contrast that you see over here. It shows up bright when the contrast is given. They travel along white matter tracks and really spread out through the brain. You can do studies where you have a glioblastoma on one side and you do a sample of what looks to be normal brain on the other side of the brain, and you'll see glioblastoma cells. This, unfortunately, is an aggressive tumor that really is always all throughout the brain at time of presentation. So again, it should just be glioblastoma now. Glioblastoma is the most common primary tumor in adults. So that could potentially be a test question. What's the most common primary tumor in adults? And we would say some tumors you've never heard of, and then glioblastoma, and the right answer would be glioblastoma. It unfortunately is, it really is the most common, and you know, John McCain, whenever these famous people, the Senator Kennedy or whatever, Congressman, whatever he was, Kennedy, when famous people get brain tumors, often it is glioblastoma. Incidence is 3 per 100,000. The average survival from time of diagnosis is approximately 13 months, so you can tell this is a very it's a serious and potentially deadly tumor. It's one that can be difficult to treat. Now, there are certain factors that, you know, that's an average survival, and for many people it's longer because there are a lot of patients who at time of diagnosis have an unresectable tumor, and if they're older, don't undergo treatment and die shortly from after the time of diagnosis. Some factors that make you more likely to live longer for glioblastoma are age under 65, if you don't, if you have a good performance status and don't have a neurologic deficit, or if your tumor is able to be resected. There's a direct correlation between the extent of resection and the length of a person's life in patients with glioblastoma. And okay, there it is right there at the bottom of the slide. But for your purposes, no, it's the most common primary tumor, glioblastoma, in adults, primary brain tumor. It's also sometimes been referred to as a butterfly glioma. This is an MRI as if the person's sliced like this. So the left eyeball would be over here, the right eyeball would be over here, you're slicing back, and the tumor starts in one side of the brain and actually goes, travels across the corpus callosum, which is a white matter tract that connects the hemispheres of the brain, and is on to the other side. And in many cases like this, it's not really a resectable tumor, and that contributes to the poor overall survival with these patients. And here's just a pathologic specimen. You can see the, you know, the cells are just spread all through the brain. It's a very aggressive tumor. So standard therapy for glioma is surgery. The extent of resection is directly correlated to survival. That said, you know, depending on where the location is, it's not always resectable. If you, you know, permanently debilitate the person by doing a surgery, it really usually isn't a good outcome. So a lot of the ability to resect this tumor is determined by where in the brain it's located. If it's not surgically resectable, at least a biopsy to confirm the diagnosis. And then standard treatment involves external beam radiation therapy and temozolomide. Temodar is a pill that's taken along with the radiation therapy. So, as I said, extent of resection is correlated with survival. We have this is a functional magnetic resonance image. So here's the tumor here on the right side. It's near the motor cortex, and they can, during the MRI, have a person, you know, tap their foot, tap their finger to show exactly where the motor cortex is. You can see it's behind the tumor, so it guides the surgery from the front to remove the tumor completely, at least what you see on the MRI, and then the patient would undergo chemotherapy and radiation. And the radiation is basically not the entire plane, but a pretty significant field around the cavity where a tumor is located. So the standard therapy diagnosis, surgery if resectable, radiotherapy and oral chemotherapy, temozolomide, is standard treatment. And just as of 2 weeks ago, added to the standard therapy is a device, the trade name is Optune. It's alternating electrical currents, and basically after that chemo radiation, this is a very controversial device. There was strong industry support to kind of get it through to the point, but it's now part of the NCCN recommendations. And it's basically something patients shave their head, say wear this for 18 hours a day. They're little stickies that go all over their head and connect to that backpack, and it creates a low-dose electrical field constantly throughout the day. And that low-dose electrical field disrupts the mitotic action of the cells and has some effect to slow the progression of the disease. So this would be another potential test question. True or false, alternating electrical field therapy can be used to treat glioblastoma. And so that's something that is true. It's something that you want to be aware of, that it's now part of the NCCN recommendations for treatment for glioblastoma. So after initial treatment, you monitor for recurrence. At each recurrence, there's potential for additional treatments that can be used. One is gliadin wafers, are part of a clinical study here on these. They are a mustard-based chemotherapy within the wafer itself that you put into the walls of the surgical cavity, and it diffuses out over time to try to kill cells in the brain surrounding your surgical resection cavity. Vaccines, which you'll hear about more, and certainly here at Roswell Park, my partner Dr. Fenstermaker and Dr. Shalsky developed one of the most promising vaccines for gliomas. Laser interstitial thermal therapy involves placing a probe into the brain, into the area of tumor, particularly for tumors where there's not a safe corridor to resection. And then you heat the laser, and it's a reproducible wavelength of light that creates a temperature that can be monitored in real time in the MR suite in order to thermally coagulate the areas of tumor. Stereotactic radiosurgery, which is the focus of high-dose radiation that can be used to treat recurrent glioma. Okay, meningiomas. So this is a different type of tumor. Meningiomas are benign tumors that arise from the arachnoid cap cells. Over time, they can grow. They typically grow slowly over time. The brain accommodates around them. And eventually, if they start to push on the normal brain, they can cause symptoms and be discovered. That said, they're incredibly common. They're more common in women. They're more common as you age. And so there's a lot of people who have incidental meningiomas that never grow and never require any treatment. And you can see it here attached to the dura, or the covering of the brain from which it arises. So as I said, they develop from the arachnoid cap cells of the dura. Most are WHO grade 1 or benign. There are much less commonly more malignant meningiomas. So meningiomas are named after where the part of the brain from which they arise. Here is it's called the sphenoid wing meningioma. It grows from the sphenoid wing, or the bone of the skull base. This is called an olfactory groove meningioma. It's a meningioma growing from the olfactory groove of the skull base. Here's a cerebellopontine angle, or CP angle meningioma. Similar initial therapy that you would have for a glioma: start anti-epileptics and steroids. In some instances, as I said, if they're small, if they're not growing, if they're found incidentally, they're just followed with serial MRIs, treated with observation. If they're small, typically less than 3 centimeters, they can be treated with stereotactic radiosurgery. And if they're larger or they're symptomatic, in those cases, they will sometimes be treated with surgical resection. And you can see here the, the difference in appearance from the meningioma in the normal brain, and usually there's a cleft so it can be separated from the normal brain. So here is a case example of a 62-year-old female who presented with gait instability. On physical exam, she had an ataxic gait and lower extremity hyperreflexia. And she had this meningioma actually just below her brain in the top of her cervical spinal cord, and it was pushing. Here's the spinal cord coming down, and it was pushing against it. Let's see if this works. Well, it doesn't look like that video is working. Here's another example. A 6-year-old female who presented with a change of personality. Over the past 6 months to a year, the patient had been confused and had poor short-term memory. She's always pleasant, which her husband said is unusual, and she was diagnosed with depression with psychotic features. On exam, she was awake and pleasant, obese. She had no recall. So you walk in the room and she'd say, oh, hi. And then you walk out, you come back in, oh, hi. And, you know, just unable to form any new memories. She had no sense of smell and she had difficulty moving her legs. And here you can see she had a large olfactory groove meningioma growing from her skull base up towards the brain. You can see there's significant, this is the tumor here. A significant amount of swelling around there. And so she had a bifrontal craniotomy. Follows an incision that kind of goes from ear to ear. You pull the scalp forward, take off a circle of bone, and just under there is where the tumor is. Close the covering of the brain, put the piece of bone back, close the scalp. You can see that tumor's been removed. So she had a slow recovery, just like her symptoms came on over 6 months. It took about 6 months for her to recover. She had some short-term deficit afterwards, but was able to recover pretty close to normal. So metastatic tumors are tumors that spread to the brain from another area. You can see here they often occur at the gray-white junction. Very commonly, there are multiple. There's a little one there, too. If they're less than 3 centimeters, they're often treated with stereotactic radiosurgery. If they're more than 3 centimeters, oftentimes open surgery, just removed a 5-centimeter one a couple hours ago. And if there's multiple lesions, sometimes they'll be treated with either multiple gamma knife radiosurgical treatments or whole brain radiation therapy. So the gamma knife, it's a focused dose of radiation with the radiation delivered just to the tumor, with minimal or any radiation delivered to the surrounding brain. Patient's head has to be still through it so you can specifically target that area of tumor to receive the radiation. So the patient has this is a Lexel frame that's attached to their head. We relax them, numb up the 4 spots where it's going to attach, and then attach the frame to their head. They get an MRI with the frame on, and you can see here the fiducial box during the MRI. And with that frame on and fiducial box, you can set up a 3D coordinate system, so then you can plan out on the computer a dose plan to deliver the dose to the tumor. You can get a sense here of how it's planned out on the computer. And here's just an example of a woman with lung cancer. Here's her metastasis, and 8 weeks later, after her stereotactic radiosurgery, it's gone away. And so this is an outpatient procedure. They come and go home the same day. It's really a great treatment for metastatic tumors. Leptomeningeal disease, or leptomeningeal carcinomatosis, is when tumor spreads into the spinal fluid space. This is a very difficult problem to treat because the spinal fluid is constantly in motion. And so if you have a tumor in there, it's constantly in motion. So even if you're giving radiation every day, that tumor might get some radiation that day, might not. And so it's some situation where the tumor cells just continue to divide and ultimately cause neurologic sequelae. One way to treat it is with intrathecal chemotherapy. What that involves is inserting a port that goes directly into the spinal fluid spaces in the brain. And then you can tap that port and deliver chemotherapy directly into the patient's spinal fluid spaces. And you can see here one of those ports going into the brain. You can see this patient who has tumor cells kind of all around her fluid spaces, her ventricles. And here's an example of a guy who blogged about his experience. The incision's there for that Ommaya reservoir that can then be tapped. And you can see in this picture that intrathecal medication or chemotherapy is being delivered. So hydrocephalus is the buildup of cerebrospinal fluid resulting in an increased intracranial pressure. Everyone has ventricles or fluid spaces within their brain. And in these fluid chambers in the center of the brain, you're constantly making spinal fluid, and you make it, and it travels down, and it bathes the brain, and bathes the spinal cord, and then you reabsorb it. And you typically make the fluid and reabsorb the fluid at approximately the same rate. What can happen if you're not reabsorbing it at the appropriate rate? You can get a backup and all that fluid can build up. Very rarely you can abnormally make too much spinal fluid as well, which also can lead to a buildup of this fluid. Patients develop, as this fluid backs up, it results in an increase in intracranial pressure, and patients develop symptoms from that increased intracranial pressure, and that's really what hydrocephalus is. And those symptoms include headaches, nausea, vomiting, sleepiness, confusion, lethargy, and coma, and rarely death. So you can get a sense here. It can be communicating or obstructive. If there's a mass blocking the flow of fluid, it's considered obstructive. There's a person who's standing this way and is sliced in half. Here's the top of his head, nose, mouth, there's a tongue. Here's the brain. Here's an abnormally large fluid space or ventricle. Typically, this fluid would go from the lateral ventricle through this hole into the third ventricle, and then it travels down this way. But with this tumor here, the fluid can't travel down, so it gets backed up. This is considered obstructive hydrocephalus because that fluid can't get through and it's starting to back up. Treatments include ventriculoperitoneal shunting. That's a permanently implanted sinelastic catheter. One end goes into the fluid space, it runs under the skin and drains into the peritoneal cavity. And there's a valve to regulate the amount that's being drained, and you constantly drain off that fluid. Another way is through a procedure called an endoscopic third ventriculostomy. And what you do is put a scope in through here, and there's a membrane here that prevents the fluid from draining, so it's all funneled this way. But you can put your scope in and make a hole here, so then this fluid can drain off in a different direction. So here's a case of a 58-year-old man with colon cancer who had worsening headaches and confusion. You can see he has multiple tumors in the brain, and he again had an obstruction that was causing a backup of fluid and symptoms of hydrocephalus. Let's see if I can bring up this video for you. So first you put a catheter into those fluid space so you know the right direction to go with your scope. You don't want to just be barreling through normal brain. Then you can follow that catheter down, and you can see that's the white and the yellowish around it is the normal brain. It's typically about 5 or 6 centimeters down until you hit the ventricle. So now we're in the lateral ventricle. That fluffy material is called choroid plexus. It's the structure that makes spinal fluid. There's the thalamus striating. It confirms that you're in the right lateral ventricle. And now passing into the third ventricle, those are the mammillary bodies at the top of the brainstem. It's the floor of the third ventricle. That's the area where you're going to puncture a hole, so the fluid has a different direction with which to flow. First, you take a scope and kind of make a mark in the floor. You want to be in that translucent area. So you can tell your mark's a little too far behind, so you go move forward. And then you sequentially increase the amount of pressure you're putting on this thin membrane until you poke through. And you can see there now there's a hole or stoma in the floor of the third ventricle that presents a new way for this fluid to flow. That right there is the basilar artery. So this is the basilar artery coming up, and these are perforating blood vessels coming off, going into the brainstem. If you bump into or damage any of those arteries, it will cause a brainstem hemorrhage and death. So you have to be very careful as you go through not to bump it. You do want to get through a couple times so that any adhesions are free. You kind of go through one last time. You can see the basilar well pulsating. This is what's called the prepontine cistern.
Kind of go back and forth, look at all those little vessels going into the brainstem. Once you come back, now you can see that it's really pulsating up and down because there's a pressure head to force the spinal fluid down through your stoma. And there's a little flimsy piece there that might try to get rid of so there's not the stoma doesn't scar down, but that's pretty wide now. It's flapping up and down. So I'm probably, I guess it one more time. Get through. There's that, again, that basilar artery. That's the clivus, the bony structure in the front. I'll probably stop there. It's going up and down. The fluid's flowing through. You don't have any significant bleeding. It's a good time to stop. Oh, I was still going. All right, finally I stopped. I'm nervous even watching it. You come back up, that's the fornix, the structure that goes around the foramen of Monroe, and then you come out through the brain. And that's a life-saving maneuver, and that allows the patient for the rest of their life to have a new pathway for that spinal fluid to flow. Let's see if I have that other one in here. So pituitary tumors, they're tumors that arise from the pituitary gland. The pituitary gland is a gland that hangs from the base of the brain. It controls all hormone function in the body. There are two lobes, an anterior and posterior lobe. Pituitary is able to sense in different hormone levels in your body to regulate control of your hormones. So it sends a signal to the thyroid gland to make thyroid hormone. It measures the amount of thyroid hormone in the bloodstream in order to either send more signal or less signal to the gland. It controls hormone, all of your reproductive organs. It sends cortisol to your adrenals. It is the hormone regulator of the body. Most common tumor of the pituitary gland is something called a pituitary adenoma. It's a benign tumor that is very common. Up to 20% of people with MRIs can have pituitary adenomas. Often they are small and don't require any treatment. Less common than pituitary adenoma. Pituitary adenomas don't secrete any hormone abnormally. If you have a tumor in the pituitary gland that's abnormally secreting hormone, you can have potentially Cushing's disease if it's abnormally secreting cortisol, acromegaly if it's abnormally secreting growth hormone, or prolactinomas if it's abnormally secreting prolactin. Pituitary adenomas are typically benign. They're seen in approximately 5% of the normal population. The microadenomas are less than 1 centimeter, rarely require any treatment. Macroadenomas are greater than 1 centimeter. Small ones are usually treated with observation. I have a huge amount of people who had an MRI because they have migraines. They see a small pituitary adenoma, I image them once a year. It doesn't grow or change over time, does not require any treatment. If the pituitary is growing or putting pressure on the surrounding structures, the pituitary adenoma is growing, it might require treatment. If the pituitary adenoma puts pressure on the normal pituitary gland, it can affect hormone production for the body. Right near the pituitary gland, this is, again, sliced in this way. So the left eye would be over here, the right eye would be here. Here's the brain. The pituitary gland hangs down here. This is the optic chiasm. Carries the visual information from the optic nerves back towards the brain. If a pituitary adenoma grows, it can push on that optic chiasm and affect vision. This would be a test question, something along the lines of, can a pituitary tumor affect hormone function in the body? And the answer to that would be yes, because if it grows and pushes on the normal pituitary, it can affect hormone function, or if it abnormally secretes the hormone. But for your purposes, just know that it can, a pituitary tumor can affect hormone function. So when they require surgical resection, you can do what's called a transsphenoidal surgery to remove it. It hangs down from the base of the brain just behind the sinus cavity, so you actually can put a scope in through the nose, identify it through the sinus cavity, and remove a tumor in that way. This isn't working. So this is a view. We've gone up through the nose, removed the back wall of the nasal cavity to get into the sphenoid sinus, removed the back wall of the sphenoid sinus, and behind that is the dura or covering of the brain and the space where the pituitary gland sits. That dura has been opened, so now you see spinal fluid flowing down, and we're widening it out to access the area where the tumor is, and you can see us pulling that tumor out now. Once the tumor's out, look around to make sure there isn't any tumor left behind. And then the issue is you kind of have this hole in the back of the person's skull that spinal fluid can leak out, so you have to reconstruct the skull base to prevent a persistent spinal fluid leakage. If you have spinal fluid leaking out, it means the bacteria in your sinuses can get in and cause a meningitis. So that's a pretty good picture right here. That's the optic chiasm up through here. The brain's pulsating. There's a layer of arachnoid behind it. This kind of purplish stuff in the back is the normal pituitary gland. So you take a piece of fat from the patient's abdomen and you use that to kind of fill the space. Then you can take a layer of their sinus mucosa and rotate it around, that's what you're seeing there, and shove it up there to seal it off. And then we have this like sealant type material that we split or spray. And it's like a glue and some other hardening foam to keep everything bolstered up there to prevent spinal fluid leakage. Cushing's disease, named after Harvey Cushing, father of modern neurosurgery, who patients with Cushing's disease have cortisol ACTH secreting tumors. The ACTH goes to the adrenal glands and stimulates an abnormal amount of cortisol. They get the same symptoms that patients get with iatrogenic steroid administration. The treatment for that is surgical resection. These can be challenging surgically because oftentimes they're very small. And so as opposed to a big mass, they're very small. So in order to identify them, sometimes we'll take samples in the veins just next to the pituitary gland to determine what side has the abnormal elevation in ACTH to help guide our surgical resection. Acromegaly, excess growth hormone secretion, enlarging hands and feet. Patients get bilateral carpal tunnel because all the structures in their wrists expand. They often have diabetes mellitus, and they frequently get dilated cardiomyopathy. As they get larger and larger, their heart is overworked and they develop a cardiomyopathy. Andre the Giant, I just had a documentary on him on HBO, he had acromegaly. Many people who are, patients who have acromegaly all kind of end up looking similar. It affects your facial features. Over time, you can kind of spot them out from the crowd. You can spot professional athletes that are abnormally taking growth hormone. They all kind of look alike. Sometimes it can be treated with somatostatin analogs. Oftentimes it requires a surgery to remove the tumor. Unfortunately, Andre the Giant died of dilated cardiomyopathy. Prolactinoma. Prolactin is a hormone that's involved normally in milk production after a woman has a child. In cases where patients have a prolactinoma, women can abnormally start lactating even if they didn't just give birth. This is a tumor that can be treated with medication. Bromocriptine in almost all cases causes the tumor to involute, and so surgery isn't required. So learning points, The most common primary brain tumor is glioblastoma. The characteristics used to describe a glioma are, you know, everything on that slide: Ki-67 proliferation index, cell mitoses, nuclear atypia, vascular proliferation, and, you know, all of the above. It would be all of the above. Standard GBM glioblastoma therapy and, you know, alternating electrical field therapy is used to treat glioblastoma. You know, that's something that you would know. And then pituitary tumors can cause a hormonal disturbance. Thank you. Any questions? Okay. Yeah, let's see what else. I can see what other videos we have. All right. So this is a person who had a tumor in their cauda equina. Cauda equina is the nerve roots at the bottom of the spinal cord. So they are laying flat or prone. The bone overlying their nerve roots at the base of their spine has been removed, the spinous process and lamina. And so you're looking at the fecal sac, which is the dura, covering all those nerve roots at the base of the spinal cord, kind of down here. The spinal cord terminates at the high lumbar spine, and below it is just nerve roots. And so the patient had a tumor that was kind of intermixed with those nerve roots and was getting symptoms, weakness, and pain. So we removed the bone. Now we're under the microscope, and we're opening the dura. So now the dura has been reflected back, and we're looking in. This tissue paper, white stuff, is the arachnoid that kind of overlies the structures in there. And underneath you can see all these little nerve roots. So somewhere mixed in with those nerve roots is the metastatic tumor that's been causing the patient's symptoms. So by freeing up the arachnoid, you can mobilize those nerve roots, and now you can see it as kind of a purple ball. In there is this area of metastatic tumor. Let's see, snip off the arachnoid. You can't tug down. If you tug on anything, you can put traction on the spinal cord and cause the person to become, you know, permanently paraplegic or quadriplegic. The tumor's mixed in with these nerve roots, and so I dissect around it until I separate really the tumor as best I can, and just those parts of the nerve fascicles that are stuck to the tumor. And so we have a monitor in the operating room that we can put on those nerves and see if they're functional. And so we find those portions of the nerves that aren't functional, and once we confirm that they're not functional, we coagulate them and cut them to separate them from the tumor. And so that, you know, you start at the bottom. You don't want to put any traction up above. Now the tumor's been separated all around. Assistant's holding it up. There's one last part of nerve fascicle that's stuck to the tumor. Again, we stimulate it first, confirm it's non-functional. Once you've made that confirmation, that's a bipolar coagulation. You coagulate it and excise it. And then it should be pretty close to getting all the way around the backside of the tumor. Again, you want to separate it rather than just pull. Okay, there's the tumor coming out. Now, you irrigate it, and you can see those nerve roots kind of spread back out into the place they normally want to be. Looking around, just make sure all the tumor's been removed. Once you're confident that the tumor's been removed, you can close the dura. You want to make sure it's closed in a watertight fashion. Again, that spinal fluid's leaking out, it means an infection can get in and cause meningitis. So, and that's, you know, sewn up. We have the patient do a Valsalva maneuver, which kind of increases the pressure for a minute to confirm there's no spots leaking out. And then once you've done that, that's the completion of the case.
How long does it take
for you? Maybe about 4 hours or so. Okay. Any other questions?
Sure, thank you.